Okay, so like I said earlier on, I hope you're all settling in and happy and well this morning, this afternoon even, just going. So recently in the Triratna Buddhist order, there's been a bit of discussion about animism. So that's kind of the theme I'm going to be looking at a bit in my talk today. And this has come about because Subhuti, who's one of Sangharakshita's sort of main disciples and a senior disciple who you may have heard of, did a series of kind of interviews with Sangharakshita, more around the theme of imagination and the importance of imagination in the spiritual life, practicing Buddhism. But within that, they kind of touched on this subject of animism. And I'll say a bit more about what that means, but certainly how so I'll say a bit how Sangharakshita would interpret animism, which is mainly seeing nature as alive and relating to it as a living thing rather than seeing it as sort of dead, inert matter. That's very simply put what animism means. But he also had this, he said this statement, he says he doesn't think enlightenment is possible if you conceive of the world as being dead, essentially, or dead matter. He doesn't think it's possible to get enlightened if you have that world view. And I guess I sort of think, well, probably people don't have it that view literally. But we've sort of moved away, definitely in our culture, from seeing the world as the universe as really alive, in perhaps the more pagan way of seeing the universe. So in a way, he's encouraging us to sort of try and recontact that more pagan view of the universe. So I'll be saying more about that. And I'll just read a little poem of Sangharakshita's, another one. He wrote it in 1952 when he was living in Kalimpong in India. And it's called Animist. I feel like going down on my knees to this old mountain and these trees. 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, I could have worshipped them, I know. But if one did so in this age, they'd lock him in a padded cage. We've made the world look mean and small and lost the wonder of it all. So that gives you some sense of where he's coming from when he talks about animism, hopefully. I'll say a bit more in a minute. So for me, the fact that this has sort of come out recently in the Triratna Buddhist order as a sort of subject for discussion, it feels like a very happy coincidence, because it's something I've personally been getting more and more interested in the last few years, myself, just sort of independently, really. I've been kind of moving in that direction of wanting to see, relate to nature in a more imaginative way and see it as alive. And for some reason it's become very important and close to my heart. So I was actually quite surprised when this came out as a sort of theme for discussion, or that Sangharakshita wanted people to think about and talk about these ideas. I'm very pleased and actually reassured, because I wondered whether I was maybe kind of going off on a bit of a tangent away from the Dharma, and maybe getting interested in fairies and things wasn't really in keeping with Buddhism. But it seems, in a way, what he's saying, that it's actually not a bad thing at all. So when I got asked if I'd help out with this retreat, the idea was that we'd kind of share our own, whatever we wanted to talk about, really, whatever was current for us. And so for me, this theme of animism was very current. And I thought, oh, it'd be an opportunity to maybe share some of my thoughts and actually go out on a limb a bit, because I feel, you know, I don't feel that confident about sharing some of these ideas. I feel a bit, you know, sort of slightly nervous about it in a way. It's because it's so personal, you know, I suppose, and maybe slightly afraid that people think it's a bit silly or something. So I think it's quite good, actually, to me, to just try and see what happens if I sort of share these ideas with you. So that then has become, in a way, the underlying theme of the retreat, or nature and one's relationship to nature sort of grew out of that, I would say. That's why we've got this theme, really. So I'll just say a little bit more about what animism is, or at least try and give some idea of what it is. So the dictionary definition, one of the dictionary definitions, is that it's the belief that natural objects, phenomena, and the universe itself have desires and intentions. So I don't know if I... That's one definition. That's what the dictionary says anyway. So,
Would you mind repeating that?
Yeah. Animism is the belief that natural objects, phenomena, and the universe itself have desires and intentions. So I suppose another way of saying that is that there is a kind of consciousness in nature to some extent. And I think that is in keeping with Sangharakshita's views, that consciousness is quite a mysterious thing. It's not just necessarily something that we as human beings have, or just human beings and animals, but maybe there's levels of consciousness, different levels, degrees. So maybe a rock has a certain amount of consciousness. Maybe it's not able to sort of speak out loud like us, but maybe there's some sort of, maybe even consciousness is what animates everything, perhaps, on some level. And the other definition in the dictionary was a kind of from Greek interpretation of it, which is that there's a hypothesis that there's an immaterial force which animates the universe. There's some sort of force behind everything that gives everything life. That's kind of Plato and Pythagoras, apparently. So there's similar understanding of it. But I guess to kind of flesh that out a bit, when I think of the word animism, I tend to think of nature being personified in some way. So-called primitive cultures would perhaps see a river as a goddess. They would relate to a river as a goddess, or a mountain as a god, or see the sun as a god, or see natural plants as alive, and would have kind of a deep respect, perhaps, for those things. I suppose I tend to connect with it with the idea of nature spirits, fairies, all of that, elementals. That would be another way of interpreting it, I guess. So I think there's quite a lot of cultures probably that still have that animistic view of the world, that it's still alive for them. They still see beings that we don't see. They still see non-human beings that we don't see. And I guess in our modern Western scientific culture, we tend to sort of see that as their imagination, that that's not really real in some way, that what they're experiencing is kind of a bit of a fantasy and naive and primitive. But I'm not so sure that that's actually true. And I suppose I kind of would like to question that and get us to question whether that's true. I think maybe what's happened is because we used to have that, I would imagine, in our culture, maybe before Christianity came along, we would have had, perhaps in pagan times, we would have had that relationship with nature. Maybe it would have been much more taken as read that there were other beings other than humans and animals around us, and they would have seen them and maybe feared them or respected them and have some kind of relationship with them. But I think we've somehow been conditioned out of seeing them. I think you can actually, as a culture, be conditioned out of perceiving something and maybe conditioned into seeing things as well, differently. Definitely, in the time of the Buddha, in India, they lived in a very animistic world. They saw beings and they communicated with beings. The Buddha, if you look in the Buddhist early Buddhist scriptures, there's basically lots of stories of the Buddha's life and his wandering around India and teaching. And there's lots of incidences of the Buddha talking to nature spirits, talking to gods from different kind of realms. They call them yakshas, which is kind of like a nature spirit, or a yaka, sometimes it's called. Or devas, we also have this phrase of devas, which is a kind of word for a god. And the Buddha taught devas, apparently. He kind of had exchanges with nature spirits. Sometimes they were friendly, sometimes they were unfriendly. Sometimes they're trying to harm the Buddha or the Buddha's disciples, and you get stories of a little exchange say, for example, between a sort of a yaksha who was angry that the Buddha was meditating in his kind of his grove, and he sort of threatened the Buddha, and he said, "If you don't come out, I'll kind of throw you across the river, or I'll bludgeon you with a club, or something like that." And so the Buddha sort of obeyed him. He said he got out, and then he said, but the yaksha kind of quite liked playing with that little game, and said, "Right, go and sit in again." And then he said, "Then go out again." And the Buddha just sort of followed his sort of instructions. And at some point, the yaksha asked the Buddha about the nature of existence in a way, and the Buddha gave him an answer, and that actually converted this nature spirit to respecting the Buddha. And from then on, he became a sort of follower of the Buddha. So you get, not only do you get that happening with the Buddha and human beings, but you get that happening with nature spirits and gods as well. This kind of the Buddha meeting various beings, having an exchange, and then them sort of having faith in the Buddha's understanding and teaching, and sort of becoming a follower of the Buddha. And I think probably when initially when Buddhism was coming over to Europe and the West, people who were doing the translating and interpreting of the texts tended to think, well, that was all a bit of a sort of fairy story type stuff, not really real, not really true. It was just a kind of colourful thing, a kind of literary device or something, and they tended to play that down or even edit it out of the original Buddhist texts. Fortunately, now that's kind of been redressed, and those sort of that material is now included in what you read about Buddhism. Because I think it's not seen like that. I think it's very much part of the Indian view that that's how they would have experienced things. There's a few sort of classic examples of this sort of thing in the Buddha's life story. There's one where the Buddha's getting enlightened, or he's about to get enlightened, which is sort of a major turning point in his life. And Mara, who is the sort of, you could say, the equivalent of the Buddhist devil, although he hasn't quite got the same nastiness or sting or fearfulness that maybe the devil would have in Christianity, he sort of challenges the Buddha and says, "So who do you think you are to sit on this spot, where the spot of enlightenment?" And he sort of says, "You know, you shouldn't be here, you shouldn't be doing this." And the Buddha says, "Well, the earth is my witness." And at that point, the earth goddess rises up and bears witness to the fact that the Buddha had spent many lifetimes practicing as a bodhisattva, practicing acts of compassion, deepening his understanding and wisdom, and that he was quite right to be sitting there. He had every right to sit and claim to be about to get enlightened. I've got a picture here, which I'll pass around, which is done by an order member called Arloka, which is one of my favourite drawings of his. I just love the style of the drawing. It is a bit like Victorian fairy story type drawing in a way. He's kind of used that style. And you've got the Buddha and the earth goddess on one side rising up out of the earth, and then you've also got Mara on one side, a sort of depiction of Mara. And I just did a little bit of research into some other texts from the early Buddhist texts to give you some examples. So I'll read out one and just say a bit about another. So this is a little short sutra, which is an exchange between a local god and one of the Buddha's disciples or followers in the time of the Buddha. So the god says, what's happened is there's this disciple of the Buddha, a monk, who's sniffed a flower. He's just been smelling a flower. I think it's a lotus flower. And this little nature spirit or god appears and says, "This lotus blossom which you sniff, though it's not been offered to you, is thus something that's been stolen. You, sir, are a stealer of scents." And the bhikkhu or the monk replies, "But I don't take, nor do I break. I sniff the lotus from afar. So really, what reason have you to call me a stealer of scents? He who uproots them by the stalk and consumes the pale lotuses, the one engaged in such cruel work, why do you not say this of him?" And the nature spirit responds, "A person who's ruthless and cruel, defiled like a workman's garment, to him my words would mean nothing, but it's fitting I speak to you. For an unblemished person who's always pursuing purity, Even a hair tip of evil seems to him as large as a cloud. And the disciple, the monk, replies, "Truly, O Yaksha, you know me and have concern for my welfare. Do please, O Yaksha, speak again whenever you see such a thing." And the Yaksha replies, "I don't live to serve upon you, nor will I do your work for you. You should know for yourself, O monk, how to go along the good path." So it's just a little exchange, and taking the not given is a Buddhist principle, or abstaining from taking the not given is a Buddhist principle. So it's just a little teaching about that, and there's a local spirit who's tried to help this monk in his practice of ethics on a very subtle level. And there's also another little sutta which I quite liked. I'm not going to read it all out, but there's a follower of the Buddha who's about to die. He's very ill, and it says that a large number of garden devas, forest devas, tree devas, and devas inhabiting herbs, grasses, and also forest giants assembled and said to him, "Make this wish. In the future, may I become a king, a wheel-turning monarch." So basically, they're saying, "You're about to die. Make some sort of desire for your next life." And he kind of admonishes them, saying, "You know, what's the point in being concerned with that? Everything is impermanent. Why should I do that?" And there's a bit of an exchange. But I just like this thing of there are all these different kinds of devas or spirits that get enumerated as or spirits that have of the garden, of the forest, trees, grasses, and even forest giants. And I also found there's a sort of classification of all the different realms of existence. In Buddhism tradition, you have this idea that there's different realms. There's God realms, and they're subdivided up into all sorts of different sort of a hierarchy, if you like, of more and more subtle, rarefied realms. And then you come down to a realm that's just above the human realm, where there's kind of the more grosser forms of gods. And it actually says that there's a sort of 31 planes of existence, which includes also, I should say, sort of hell realms as well, and realms of hungry ghosts. But there's this realm of the four great kings, which is just above our realm, if you like. And it says it's the home of the Gandharvas and the Yakshas, who are nature spirits of varying degrees of ethical purity. And it says here, actually, the latter, they're sort of analogous to goblins, trolls and fairies in Western tradition, which I was very pleased to come across, because I've been wondering how to fit in this interest with fairies and stuff, and so where does that fit in the Buddhist scheme of things, the view of the universe and the different realms. So, anyway. So for us, fairies and the like have become myth and legend. We use this word myth to mean it's not actually true, don't we? So it's sort of fantasy. But in the time of the Buddha, it was obviously very real for them. It wasn't a myth. It was true. So I said we've been conditioned out of it, out of seeing them. So first of all, Christianity came along, and in Greek times they recognized all these different beings as well. They had what they called daemons, and they were sort of intermediaries between the gods and men. There was this sort of intermediary level of sort of semi-godlike beings, which they called daemons. Christianity came along and said, no, there's only one God. All these other intermediate beings are not good. They demonized them, which means they sort of said they were evil and they shouldn't be worshipped. We should just worship the one God, of Christianity. And Jesus becomes the only sort of intermediary between man and God. Whereas before that you had many gods and you had these lots of intermediary sort of semi-divine beings, which they called daemons. But that's where the word demonized comes from. It's to do with sort of going from seeing these daemons as perhaps helpful to seeing them as definitely evil and sort of banished. So then after Christianity sort of established itself in the West, in Europe, then science and I think the Enlightenment and sort of the more rationalistic view of the universe somehow emerged. And I think I've heard a suggestion that that comes out of the sort of Protestant view of things, where kind of images became increasingly banished from churches. Somehow this sort of rationalist scientific view has emerged, and that's really dealt the death blow, I think, to this way of seeing things. And we live now in a world that's kind of founded on that scientific view of the universe, I think. It's fairly well established, you could say. But, however, I think the fascination with all of this world, I would say, still remains. I don't know about you, but I certainly feel it. And I was just thinking, well, in our modern culture, even now, there's like a very strong fascination for fantasy-type stories, films, Lord of the Rings, that sort of thing. It's very popular, isn't it? People like that sort of thing. There's still some sort of attraction for, in a way, seeing the universe as being alive and magical. People want a sense that that the world is magical. There's magic there. I suppose I feel through practicing Buddhism, I think it does give you back some sense that is real, actually, through meditation and the like. You do get given back some sense that is actually a possibility, that there is some sort of magic in the universe. Science hasn't completely managed to obliterate it. I was also thinking, why are garden gnomes so popular still? You know, they just don't seem to go away, do they? People want to have little gnomes in their gardens. You know, and I think maybe that's the kind of... That's the sort of tail end of that whole worldview, still just sort of persisting. And I personally, in a way, I think those garden gnomes are probably nearer to what fairies look like than the sort of more Victorian, pretty female, maybe little spirits with sort of Barbie doll figures with little wings, and they're very nice. I think actually gnomes and fairies traditionally were quite dangerous beings. They weren't beings that you'd mess with. You know, you had to respect them, although they would do things to you. You know, they'd come and steal your baby away and swap it for a fairy baby and stuff like that. So, you know, I think it's good to bear that in mind, in a way, that having a sort of respectful attitude is probably very sensible to these beings. I was also thinking maybe the fact that science now is... So it seems to be moving in directions where it's coming up with these theories about the universe that seem so mind-bendingly sort of incomprehensible in a way. I don't really sort of look into it that much, but occasionally you hear people talking about some of the theories of science now. It's almost like science is trying to move back to proposing things that are kind of pretty way out and magical in a way. The sort of theories about multi-parallel universes and holes through to other universes, that sort of thing, which is Quark, yeah, those sort of things. It's sort of I imagine it's a bit Harry Potter-esque almost, some of that stuff. And the two maybe are feeding on each other, the sort of fantasy world of fantasy literature and films and stuff, sort of feeding on that. But also, on top of that, I think the fact remains that there's still people in our modern Western culture who do see strange things. And actually, I think it's probably a lot more common than we really give credence. I certainly have seen strange things which can't be explained. And I know other people who have, and hear of other people through friends who've seen strange things. People have seen fairies. People have seen strange pan-like figures or mysterious horned beings on Dartmoor and all sorts of things. And I think mysterious lights in the sky... Maybe UFOs are a kind of modern equivalent of fairies. I've read a very interesting book about where that's someone looking into all those different phenomena that people still seem to see in our modern Western scientific culture. Yetis, Bigfoot, you know, all that sort of stuff. So maybe we haven't managed to completely banish them yet. Sangharakshita, in fact, has seen many strange beings in his life. I heard that he'd seen nymphs, water nymphs, at Guhyaloka. There's a sort of spring Agricola, and he'd seen nymphs playing at this beautiful little spring in the mountains. If you read his autobiography, he also says that he's met Mara, who I was talking about, the Buddhist equivalent of devil, I suppose you could say. He said he was giving a lecture in India, I think, somewhere, and he was talking about Buddhism, and there was this sort of heckler at the back of the lecture, who kept sort of interrupting and criticising him and sort of challenging his things he was saying. And at the end, he came up to him and he met him and he shook his hand and he said there was this incredible icy coldness about this being, and he recognised him from a meditation he'd had years before, where he'd had this thought that he was experiencing some particular refined level of consciousness, and this being had appeared in his meditation and said, "No, you're not. You're not experiencing that. You can't experience it." And then he thought, "Well, yes, I can, because I am experiencing it." And this figure disappeared, and he appeared in this lecture years later. Okay. I mean, when I read it, I thought, "Could he really be saying this?" You know, it's kind of, it's pretty way out, really. But he very matter-of-factly claims that that's the case. So take that as you will. I think there's another example where he was meditating and hungry ghosts appeared to him, which is another realm in Buddhism, in the Buddhist wheel of life. You have these very unhappy, sad beings who inhabit this realm where they're perpetually hungry and unable to satisfy their hunger. And he said these beings appeared to him. He didn't really know what to do. He didn't really know how to help them. And they just sat there in front of him with these big saucer eyes, and eventually they sort of faded away and disappeared. So I've recently been finding material in his writings on all this, on this subject, and in his writings he actually actively encourages us to try and have a more animistic view of the universe. He even says he thinks it's better to sort of see, interpret nature and personify nature in this way, perhaps, of seeing fairies or goblins or elves or whatever it is, whichever way seems appropriate. He thinks that's better than seeing it as dead matter, even if it seems a bit childish. You know, if it feels a bit childish, he still thinks it's better that we adopt that view, because that's more in keeping with the way things are. There is more life out there than perhaps we give credence. And obviously I agree with that. You can probably guess I sort of very much agree with that. And I've been doing that quite naturally in my practice over the last few years. And when I do sometimes make an offering, say to the local nature spirits, which I do from time to time in my own garden in Norwich, or to the earth goddess, to fairies, I sort of often feel a kind of energy that comes from somewhere that makes me just feel much more connected to my environment, much more part of my environment, and just sort of a happiness that naturally arises from doing that. And I suppose what I see is also it's just a way of practicing metta. It's putting metta into practice to all living beings. So not necessarily just humans and animals, but if there are other beings out there, we include them as well in the practice of metta. and I've also felt quite strongly that given the sort of current environmental issues that are around, the climate change issues that we seem to be facing, I feel that maybe we're not addressing the deeper issue, or perhaps there's another way of approaching dealing with the issue, and maybe this is something that we need to, another approach that we could take sort of for approaching these issues. Because I feel that in a way it's because we've adopted that view that nature is dead matter on some level, that we've felt able to just use nature for our own ends in quite a selfish, thoughtless way and just abuse our environment. It's because we lost that animistic view, perhaps, and respect for nature and environment. I obviously feel quite strong about it, stronger than I realise in a way. So I feel that we need to maybe reconnect with these animistic, pagan way of seeing things, these roots that we've still got somewhere, and use metta as another approach to our relationship with the environment. So, in a way, I guess maybe what people are doing already is a manifestation of that concern and metta, even if we're using perhaps more scientific tools to deal with it, like turning your lights off and whatever. But maybe there's another way of approaching it. So on this retreat, I'd like to invite you to join in an experiment to adopting a more animistic view of the universe. It seems very a fitting environment to do that. See if we can open up to that way of seeing things, even if it seems a bit childish to see it like that. We've already begun, because last night we chanted the Ratana Sutta, where we sort of did a little communication with local beings, spirits and devas or whatever. And we're going to sort of pursue that hopefully a bit more, go into it a bit more depth. And maybe, you know, if you don't feel you want to do that, if it feels silly or whatever, we're also going to be just having times where we're just going to sit in nature, have little periods where we just go out on our own, find a nice spot and just sit for maybe half an hour and just be aware of your environment and just take it in. And just be receptive to the aliveness of it, the movement and the sound and how it's sort of affecting your senses, and just to enjoy it. And see what effect it has on our practice of meditation and the Dharma generally.